For WBAA, I'm Betty Carson. Grammy Award-winning pop icon Rick Springfield has written a searingly candid memoir, Late, Late at Night. Nick Schinkel, the director of the West Lafayette Public Library, reviews the book and begins by reading from the prologue entitled A Swingin' Teenager.
So here I am, 17 years of age, feeling as ugly as the ass end of a female baboon at mating season. Unloved, very much in need of a good caressing by some attentive young woman, and right now, swinging by my neck at the end of a very thick twine rope like some pathetic B-Western movie bad guy. I'm thinking to myself as I lose consciousness, wow, somehow I thought it would all end so differently. Thank God I haven't succeeded at a lot of things I've tried, like this suicide attempt, for instance. But thank God I have succeeded occasionally, because in a furious flash forward of the type that can only happen in the movies or in this book, I am 31 years old and standing on stage with a very expensive guitar strapped around my very expensive suit, playing a rock and roll song that I wrote. The audience of this sold-out show is clamoring for more. A bevy of young girls is waiting backstage for me, and there's a middle-aged bald guy standing on the side of the stage, smiling at his healthy prophet, ready to hand me a big fat check when I'm done. Well, so opens, what a great opening, so opens Late, Late at Night by Rick Springfield. Finally, a rock musician with a life worthy of a memoir. Many rock and rollers present us with mediocre dribs and drabs about their years of fame and the drug-laden years that they say they enjoyed, at least at the time. So I'm glad to recommend this book by 80s rock and soap opera phenom Rick Springfield, a memoir of his life as he titles it so far. And at nearly 63 years of age, he's got stories to tell. Not the least, the story of his hard-fought battle against the demons of depression, which open this story and provide a counterpoint to the pains and the glories of a successful rock and roll career. As another reviewer has written of Late, Late at Night, quote, this work reads somewhere between the self-deprecation of an Augustine Burroughs memoir sprinkled with the likeness of a young David Copperfield and the required sloppy fornication of a compulsive Hollywood sex rat, which is expected in a celebrity biography, end quote. I thought that was too good not to quote. Springfield is generously open and honest with this memoir. He begins his story, as we heard, with his lifelong bouts with depression, slamming his 17-year-old depressive self in our face. And he stays real from that point on. Springfield goes on to write about the highs and the lows of his music and his acting careers. For instance, he had the incredible luck of landing both a recording contract with RCA and a leading role on the afternoon soap opera General Hospital within days of each other, after a drought of both music and acting gigs that had him seriously considering life as a middle-class house husband in the suburbs of California. He's direct about his womanizing years as a pop idol, declaring more than once that sex is great fun, but it didn't do much more than put a Band-Aid, albeit a raunchy and welcome one, on his spiritual emptiness for a short time. And he's equally open about his drug use in those rock and roll earlier years. He's direct and open about his fun-loving personality, too. He labels it permanent adolescence at one point and extols both its benefits to his career and its downsides with refreshing honesty. As he writes in part, quote, music has always been a young man's game, and I am one of a peculiar subspecies. I'm a songwriter. As a songwriter, it's natural for me to stay open and receptive to everything that I and the people around me are feeling, doing, saying, and fantasizing about it. It's not a skill set that every job requires. For many people, it would be a headache they don't need. I think it's desirable for certain careers, artists, writers, actors, therapists, dog owners, and some rather spectacular mothers. I need to stay sympathetic and connected to the emotional roller coaster that most grown-ups have become desensitized to, but that they still want to hear about and be reminded of in the songs they listen to and the books they read. One consequence of this openness is that I remain pretty naive and gullible, despite the things I've gone through. The result? I am frequently deceived, which is probably only fair since I've done my share of deceiving. To this day, I'm still surprised at some people's ulterior motives when they are revealed to me. But on the whole, and especially back then, this permanent adolescence serves me well in the path I've chosen, So I'm at peace with it. Only down the line, as I take on more adult responsibilities and find them harder to shoulder, do I realize how ill-suited it leaves me for some of life's roles that I desire most. For all his fame and his admittedly adolescent tendencies, Rick Springfield portrays himself as something, too, of a family-centered man, even in his wild youth. You decide here if he's being honest with us or if he's just trying to ingratiate himself into our hearts, as he writes this. We are all brokenhearted at the loss of our old dog Cleo, Dad included. We bury her in her basket at the back of the yard, under the shade of the tree she loved to rest beneath the hot summer days. I realize again that I prefer the company of dogs. They are truly good, unconditionally loving beings, and they have never abandoned me, even though I have abandoned them. I do feel guilty for leaving Cleo while I journeyed to another land. He went from Australia to the United States. And as I had done to my best furry pal Elvis so many years before. And now, suddenly, there is a possible end to my sweet old dad's life. I know I made the choices I did because it was my path, but it doesn't make missing precious years with ones who truly matter any easier. I tell my parents, and they are happy, relieved, that I finally have a new manager. I don't let them think he might be a little green, but I am feeling positive. Any move forward is a good move, and I must get back, despite the fact that my father has cancer. He understands. Both my parents do. I think I do, too. And when he says getting back, he's talking about leaving his homeland of Australia to come back to the States, where he has found such fame and fortune. Well, Rick Springfield is not immune to name-dropping. The guy was a successful rock musician in the 1980s, after all, and he still does quite well now. Early music and partying with Elton John and his early band members. With actor Richard Chamberlain, and that must have been an interesting time. He gets to know the daughter of Frank Sinatra, but Springfield is refreshingly honest about this whole fan worship thing, whether it be people worshiping him as fans or, as he writes about his own fanboy experience, his fascination and his excitement about meeting Sir Paul McCartney. Okay, he writes, I'm going to drop one final name here, so watch your toes. I'm a music fan, first and foremost, so consequently, I'm a fan of other musicians. When I was in my teens, Paul McCartney became the guy. Seeing the Beatles was a life changer, and Paulie was the one I singled out. He was the one I most wanted to be like. His were the songs I dissected and tried to emulate. His hair was the style I tried to comb my unruly mass into a sad simulation of. I had such a boy crush on him. I kept his photo in a notebook otherwise reserved for my sacred but quite dopey poems, atrocious song lyrics, amateurish drawings, and other artsy-fartsy stuff. At some point, I left the notebook behind, but my fanship of Paulie has only grown. It's been a lifelong dream to meet the man who was the object of my teen worship. I get my chance early in 2010 at a pre-party for the Golden Globes. I know he'll be there, and in truth, it's the only reason I attend. A mutual friend has arranged an introduction. In my mind, it's just Paulie and me, mano a mano. I step up to the meeting and I'm shaking like a little girl. Paul eyes me warily, perhaps trying to decide if I'm a stalker or just another avid fan. I'm the latter, but I probably came across as the former. And of course, I'm sure it's a thrill for him to meet yet another Beatle freak. But it all goes swimmingly. Afterward, I send the resulting photo of the two of us to everyone in my email address book. And in some bizarre way, my life now seems oddly complete. I love being a fan. It puts life in perspective. And there is always more to aspire to when you're looking up. And everyone is a fan of someone. Paul is a fan of someone. I am a fan of Paul's. And someone else is a fan of mine. Rick Springfield comes across here as a working-class kid who took his Episcopalian religion seriously in his youth, if he often swerved from its moorings. And as an adult, he has embraced his own blend of Eastern mysticism and Western Christianity. You'll read more about that as you go through, or you can listen to some of his later albums. And it may surprise some of us that Rick Springfield continues an aggressive music tour schedule, at least that's what I will call performing around 100 concerts a year to be. But at its core, this is the story, the true story as it happens, of a man battling depression, Mr. D, as Springfield calls it. At the height of his fame, blessed with a happy family who live in a house in Malibu, for heaven's sake, surrounded by his loving dogs, his human friends, and his worldwide recognition for his music, Springfield yet tells us about the reappearance of his old foe, that Mr. D fellow. As he writes about his life in the late 80s, it's a spectacular Malibu morning. Soft sunlight seeps through the eucalyptus branches and splashes across the counterpane of our antique four-poster bed. I wake up in the master bedroom with its arched old barn wood ceiling and look out onto the Spanish fountain in the enclosed courtyard just beyond the bedroom's elegant, hand-milled French doors. I rouse myself and head into the Malibu-tiled master bathroom, complete with stained glass window. But I refuse to look in the mirror and greet the dark bastard. I know he's close by. It's an old farmhouse style, with a domed brick ceiling and a turreted skylight. Gleaming copper pots and pans hang from an old iron ceiling rack in the kitchen, with antique farm animal cutouts around the rim. To the right is the dining room. A hand-carved 16th-century European dining table has 10 authentic Queen Anne chairs at attention around it. And across the open kitchen counter is the large family room. I kiss B good morning, B is his wife, take the mug of steaming tea she hands me, and drop to my knees in supplication before our priceless little miracle, who's sitting in his baby walker. He smiles at me and hands his soggy, Cheerio-encrusted Big Bird toy car. Something is pushing me this morning, making me restless. I tell my son he's beautiful and take my tea out past the 20-foot ceilinged great room off to the left and through the antique carriage doors that serve as the formidable entrance to our Spanish-style home. I walk out into the sweet morning air. Ronnie, my dog, comes bounding up the long pepper tree-lined driveway, having just put the last passersby in their place with a peremptory bark, and gives me a standing double high five, making me spill half my tea. The gardeners are already hard at work here in the front of the house, so I make my way, tagged closely by my faithful hound around the side, past the stables and the half-acre riding ring to the beautifully laid-out pool area. But there are three of us walking, and I know it. I've felt this confrontation coming for a long time, and although I'm a little unsure of the course it will take, I know the drill. I begin to walk around the pool, but I am pacing more than strolling. I pass the waterfall, the tennis court, and the meditation gardens. It's a secluded and peaceful place, and I'm looking for some relief from the growing unease and discomfort that is beginning to writhe like serpents in my gut. This is not how I imagined I would feel. Sure, the darkness has again become a regular visitor on the road, and it is hovering like a starving vulture over my career in general. But I'm home now, safe with my family, and in the house of our dreams that I've worked so hard to secure. In an effort to calm what feels like the beginnings of a storm in my soul, I start to chronicle my accomplishments, because at this point, I still believe I have every reason to be satisfied, content, and maybe even happy because of what I've achieved. Wasn't this supposed to be the magic healing potion? All this really great stuff? But the darkness is pushing me, and I must face something here, even as I try to make light of it all. And I'm finally made aware of the myth of fame. It may seem like an obvious revelation, but honestly, unless you've gone through it, you can't imagine what kind of a mindfuck it really is to truly understand that, in and of itself, fame is not ultimately transformative. Well, as an off-and-on listener and aficionado of Rick Springfield's music, I've come to appreciate Springfield's interest in presenting the darker sides of life in his lyrics, with a nod on most albums to something upbeat as well, of course, not everything is sad. The man is not a PhD philosopher by far, but he is willing to craft catchy pop tunes that poke at the scabby parts of life, like depression, like spousal and parental abuse, and, of course, the meaning of life and the universe. And that, perhaps, is explained in many ways by reading this book. And yes, there is the war cry of that jilted would-be lover, probably his biggest ever hit, Jesse's Girl. Definitely, this is a book for anyone who's a Rick Springfield fan and for anyone who loves dogs as much as Rick does. They pop up again and again and again in this book. And this is a book for anyone who has or is battling depression, whether they be teenager or adult. Late at Night is a rewarding and eye-opening read. In conclusion, let's let Rick Springfield speak in his own words about what it means to be that man who has found fame, fortune, a beautiful family, and all the time finds himself battling something that he has yet to conquer. As he writes, "I love music and being a musician. For all the poor choices I've made in my life, I've made some very right ones. I'm glad I took the chance and bailed out on school when I did. Kids, if you're reading this, it's all bullshit. I'm glad that I decided to travel and play and write. I love guitars. I have them all over my house. They're beautiful individual works of art, and each one has as much soul dripping from it as Howlin' Wolf's sweaty brow on a hot night at Silvio's Lounge on Chicago's West Side. And I'm beginning to feel that maybe, just maybe, I am enough. Though every now and then, when I'm feeling good and I start humming to myself or thinking a thought that makes me smile, my old adversary will chime in, as he often has in good times before. Quote, yeah, everything's just peachy, isn't it? Hisses my darkness, which of course will switch my focus to everything that isn't peachy in my life, in my world. I know he will never let go, and maybe I deserve him. I continue to do my best and to live well, to be the man my dog Gomer thinks I am, my sons believe me to be, and Barbara is pretty sure I am in my heart. I still feel guilty over the pain that my past actions have inflicted on those I love, particularly B, but I try not to wallow in it, no matter how much my darkness thinks I should. On good days, I love my life, my girl B, my family, my music, my career choice. On bad days, I don't want to drive straight into a tree. And most days are spent somewhere in between. I think back to Gary's girl, who actually became Jesse's girl in his song, and I'm thankful I don't always get what I want. So what do I believe? I believe in the path I have chosen, the emptiness of celebrity. The things that changed me for the better are obvious to me. Barbara is my light and my love. She's the one true soul life who wants to be my companion through this life, and I hers. My precious sons, Liam and Josh, who made me realize I am not the most important person in the universe. They are. Speaking of the end, this isn't it. There will be volumes 2, 3, and 4 in this autobiographical series. Oh no, they moan in unison. I have a lot of living left, I hope, and still too much to learn. I realize now how important family has been to me, both my own and those that have adopted me when I was most in need. And I completely embrace how important it is for me to be an honest and moral person, to accept everything I'm saddled with and have created for myself, to write with veracity and passion, and to be able to absorb a good kick in the balls now and then when the world doesn't go the way I want it to. Also, to be a good shepherd of the small, furry animals. I know every story should have an ending, though thankfully my life is still going on. But I'm thinking about my own mortality lately. I hope for a painless crossing when my time comes, but whatever it will be, it will be. I'd like to suggest that the first thing I see when I cross over is a big-ass sign that reads, all is forgiven. My dad will be there, and my mom, though it's not a certainty that she'll go before me. As I've said, she's made of extremely tough stuff. And my sweet mutts will be there, too. The best line about what awaits us is the one Will Rogers said, quote, if there are no dogs in heaven, then when I die, I want to go where they went, end quote. I wholeheartedly concur. What a book. It's an interesting memoir. Thank goodness he did not entitle it an autobiography, because he's still with us and he's still got a lot to write. Late at Night, a memoir by Rick Springfield. It's a book that I think you'll enjoy on so many levels, and I think you ought to give it a chance. Give it a read and let me know what you think. It's available at all of our fine local libraries, including, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library.
That was Nick Schinkel, the director of the West Lafayette Public Library. He's reviewed Late at Night, a memoir by Rick Springfield.